let's both tell our side of the story.
So my side of the story begins with Bill Banks-Jones saying to me, who's a director who now runs the Tete a Tete Opera Festival, very extraordinary man, who called me and said, my assistant director on whatever show it was is a much more interesting director than me and has just made a site-specific production of The Tempest in a warehouse in Dalston. No, not Dalston. Albany.
Deptford.
He's very good and you should go and see it, and I completely failed to go and see it. And then I did go and see the next thing that Felix did, which was the Firebird Ball, which was in an old pop factory. Was it a pop
factory? Ceramic factory, yeah.
Near the Oval, which was a big site-specific. It was, the first of the family of three huge, big...
So there was Sleep No More before it.
Yeah.
Which I tried to get you to come to. Interesting, my part of the story. Well, you finish yours, and then mine's actually...
Okay.
The timeline's similar.
Okay, right. So I went to see that, and without knowing anything about it, and had to put a mask on. And the first room you went into there was a cellar with some very scary statues in. And I spent an hour and a half in the cellar wandering around with the statues before I realised there were any live performances in the show at all. And then I spent the rest of another hour or so kind of wandering around the building and seeing bits of action and finding it very, very, very exciting. Just the whole form of putting the audience in control of their route through a dramatic event, but in no way in control of the material they would encounter. So as if you could choose what window you looked out of, but you could never choose what you were going to see. It seemed to me a fantastic way to reanimate the relationship between audience and performer. So I had a fantastic time, and at the end went into the kind of bar bit, which was like the last scene. Although it was a sort of bar, hangout bar, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I found Felix and said I thought it was very, very good. And then he proceeded to tell me off for having missed the entire show. And I was saying, and also his producer was particularly anxious about this. And I said, no, it was, I really liked it. The bit I saw, it was fantastic. And so I thought, oh, I'll come back. And I then went back and brought Nick Heiner. Or did he come the first time, actually? I can't remember.
He might have come the first time.
Yeah, maybe I took him the first time. It was in,
so which year was this then?
2005?
Something like that. And then I spent another... Then I knew that I shouldn't spend too much time in the cellars, although I still like them. And I wandered around and saw quite a load of things that I hadn't seen before. And also became aware of some things like people being taken into little rooms by themselves and realising that I was also missing out on some quite exciting things. And loved the show even more, and then went and, full of pride, went and told Felix all the things I'd seen and managed to see, and he told me that I'd missed the entire show again. And so I've been trying to play sort of catch up ever since, really.
Mm. And interesting, my whole story was that a dear friend from university, who actually was, when we first formed a company straight out of the very, very early days of Punch Drunk, we were doing it together, and she ended up as Tom's assistant at the BAC. And I heard from her about the crazy work that was happening. I knew the only way for Punch Drunk, because we were very, very small and nobody had heard of us, the only way for us to get out there was that we had to get this man, her boss, to come and see it. And he wouldn't bloody come. We kept inviting him, and Sally kept saying, it's all right, I'll make sure he comes, I'll put it in his diary. And it was waiting for Morris. And Sleep No More, unfortunately, you didn't come to that one.
No, I didn't come.
And so,
so I missed two and got
you missed two. Yeah,
it's not bad.
No, it was just good because we just needed needed the people who would really understand it to come and see it, and then we could see whether it had any value. And it was wonderful. And then when he actually did come actually understood it. And I love the fact that you enjoyed the show without the performers, because I think it's such an important part of the work.
Yeah, ever since there's an ongoing thing about whether it matters if you miss the show within fans of Punch Drunk. And I'm the chairman of the "It Doesn't Matter If You Miss the Show" part, because it seems to me that the whole form of Punch Drunk's work teaches you to concentrate on what's in front of you and not worry about what's going on next door. And if you can just accept that, it's always fantastic. And then, especially if you go in a group to a Punch Drunk show, the golden rule is never go around in pairs. It's much more interesting to split up your group and then meet in the bar at the end and find out what the other people saw.
And I suppose when we first started talking after Firebird, we immediately started talking about music and the different ways of presenting, you know, how you could take form in different places, different directions, and music was a big part of that. And I think because there were various simple instruments working in Firebird, but I think we did bond over, wouldn't it be amazing if you could do this, that and the other?
Yeah, it struck me that neither of you were names immediately associated with that of Tom Stoppard, and I still remember the conversation where you told me that you didn't do plays at the VAC, and this is a play, isn't it? I think this is probably the first.
It's not really a play.
Well, it's sort of a play. It looks like a little bit like a play, but I mean, I don't know, how did this text become the thing that you those questions about music sort of circulated around? Did you have lots of different ideas about music plays?
Well, we were talking about ways of working with classical musicians, not in relation to making a show at the National, but just generally, because we're both separately thinking about different ways of working with
deconstructing an orchestra. Mm.
So we've been having a bit of chat about that, and then Nick Starr, who's the executive director at the National, had started talking to this extraordinary orchestra called the South Bank Sinfonia, which is it's like a scholarship orchestra for music school graduates within the first, I don't know, it's 3 or 5 years after they leave. They're able to apply, audition to join this orchestra for a year, and during the course of the year they then get to work with lots of different conductors. And as we discovered as we met the orchestra and then spoke to them more and more about what they were doing, the spirit of that year, of that bursary year, for all the people who organise the orchestra and for the players, is very much looking forward to a world in which classical music will not always be played, not always be presented in the traditional way. And this felt like a very exciting opportunity, because the received wisdom is that if you want to do any work with classically trained musicians, you just run in that isn't the conventional presentation of classical music, you run into a sort of brick wall of custom and practice. In fact, generally, not that I've done very much of it working with established orchestras or established musicians, I've not found that to be the case, but in particular with the South Bank Sinfonia it really isn't the case. Entirely the opposite is the case. And at the same time, Nick Heitner was reading early Stoppard plays, reread this one and said, this is a rather good play, actually. Of course it is a play, and so I sent a copy to Felix and said, "What do you think? This is something, this might be something that we could explore," and we started talking about it and then got very, very excited about it, both as a play in its own terms, and as a piece of integrated musical performance and theatre. That's my side of the story.
Yeah. These are things that we were thought, I suppose we as Punch Drunk were thinking that we'd be pursuing ourselves. But I think the reason why I suddenly responded to, and it's, you know, with a dream of putting musicians into a site and deconstructing that side of it. But for me, music is always the starting point of anything that I build. And if I haven't got the music, I haven't got the piece that defines the show, I can't see the show. So it was being when we were first looking at the script and Previn's score, suddenly it's fantastic. It's there, you know, step one is on the table, and it was incredibly fertile. And so it was, that was the bit that really, the play is fantastically dense, and there's so much room. It's epic. It is operatic in scale. And then you've got this Previn score that sews it all together and binds it, and it makes it something that's unlike anything else that I've really come across. It's not, to call it a play doesn't do it full justice. And obviously there's no singing, so it isn't an opera, but it is something that's more akin, it is complete total theatre. And so I think that's what pulled me on board. That's the genius of the piece, that it is about isolation, and yet the stage will be packed full of performance. We've been reading To Build a Castle by Vladimir Bukovsky, and we've went to meet the man himself, and he describes his 12 years incarceration. He talks about the ways that he, the devices and tools he used to survive solitary confinement in particular. The way he survived it, he saw many people lose the plot and succumb to madness, because that's what they were trying to encourage in a way. And so his way to defend himself was that he imagined he had a castle, and he built his castle brick by brick, and then and knew every room. He knew it in intimate detail, so he could walk down the corridors, pass through, you know, the east wing, the kitchen's down there, move through, he'd know what colour the tapestries were on the walls, this curtain's frayed a bit here. Yeah. He'd be able to sit in front of the fires and warm his hands. He'd even be able to go into the library and there pick out a book and read it. And when we went to meet him, he even said that actually Tom asked whether he could read every single book in his library. And he said, well, actually, yes, I can, although some of them are in a Gothic script, which I don't understand. So,
But they're in German. They read German, so I couldn't read them. I read all the others.
And that was his survival tool. Mm-hmm. And he's an amazing man, and you can see that he's fortified himself inside his own castle. And so using that as a way into probing what an orchestra could be for Ivanov, you know, the combination of isolation and then
it's chaos and busyness. It's a feat of imagination and memory, a bit like, I mean, Bukowski was in control of his, and it feels as if Ivanov probably isn't in control of his. In lots of other ways, they're very similar, as intricately detailed places of mental refuge. Certainly, from my point of view, making theatre, if something's on stage, you have to take responsibility for it in the world of what you're presenting.
And that's the wonder of the challenge, but the orchestra aren't in the pit. And I think that's the other thing that really attracted us to the piece, is that they're on stage, they're performers. Mm. Bloody hell, they're the biggest thing out there. There's no way you can just brush them aside and we'll deal with them later.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. I went recently to see the Mark Morris Romeo and Juliet at the Barbican, because I don't very often go to see narrative dance. It was a very strange and wonderful and exciting experience. And it was, the LSO were playing the music, and it was originally LSO that played in the initial production of this play. And they were buried under the stage, as they conventionally are. And I have a really simple reaction to that, which is, you know, it's like burying a living person. Why on earth would you do that? Of course, I understand the reasons that you have the LSO buried under a stage, but it does seem to me a terrible shame to bury the exquisite and gorgeous thing. Because if you are going to bury it, why don't you just use a recording? And I'm very passionately excited about working with live musicians. And working with them, it's not always possible, it's difficult in theatre to do this, but working with them on stage, not...
You're renowned for creating site-specific pieces that
yeah.
completely reimagine spaces, and here we have, from the sound of it, a piece that requires an audience, a stage with certain kinds of bits and pieces on it. Is that,
yeah.
is that what, do you have reservations about that, structure of
no, well, not at all. I've never actually sort of shunned the stage at all. I think my desire is to give the audience the most potent experience possible, and so in terms of explorations to date, the most efficient and most exciting methods of reinventing the audience as opposed to theatre, you know, is we're just trying to play with the question of who they are and what their journey is and the power ratio. They're much easier on a site than in a theatre. But as long as this is quite a, you know, it's a new experience for me working on stage, but because the actual product and the piece is so strong, and what we'll be delivering to the audience has the power to be so impactive, it feels quite a sort of seamless transition.